Thank you, KD&K listeners, for joining me on the Meet in the Middle show, where we share dialogue on complex issues with local thought leaders with differing opinions. The hope is for listeners to gain new perspective and empower freedom of expression. I'm Dan Richardson. My email address is richardson@roth.net. And today's topic is, what's behind the recent rise in anti-Semitism? And I should note that we are pre-recording the show on May 20th. My guest today is Rabbi Mendel Mintz. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you, Dan. It's an honor to be with you and a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Rabbi Mendel Mintz is an ordained Chabad rabbi and is the founder and executive director of the Chabad Jewish Community Center, or the JCC, in Aspen. And he's also the founder of the Friendship Circle, serving and helping families with special needs kids. Thank you for doing that. Rabbi Mendel Mintz holds a degree in Judaic Studies from the Rabbinical School and was ordained in 1996. Founded in 2000, the JCC was the first center of its kind in the Roaring Fork Valley. In addition to daily operations of the community center, Rabbi Mendel Mintz also oversees the nonprofit humanitarian organization Ski to Live, and I'll do my best here, Galshim Sham.
L'chaim. Pretty good.
And he and his wife have 7 children and 2 grandchildren. So again, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
And thank you for being here and modeling respectful dialogue. That's an important component of the show. And I've found it interesting over my years of doing the show that it's not as easy as I think to get people to share their opinions on the radio. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Let's see if I can set the stage and provide a little context for the show. Anti-Semitism is certainly not new, but the question of today's show is, what's behind the recent rise in anti-Semitism? There's been a global culture of persecution of the Jews for centuries. There's been an age-old conflict between Jews and Muslims that clearly intensified after the UN granted Israel statehood in 1947. And the conflict reached another climax on October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel, and Israel's counterattack continues to this day. But even before Hamas's attack, there's been a rise in anti-Semitism in America and elsewhere, which also follows a trend in the rise in political extremism, both in the U.S. and in Israel. And so I'll throw out a few stats that always helped. Data always helps kind of bring the conversation around. According to a 2022 Pew Research Center survey, Jewish people were the targets of harassment in 94 countries in 2020, the third highest among major religious groups, with incidents ranging from verbal and physical assaults to vandalism of cemeteries and scapegoating for the COVID-19 pandemic. In each year since Pew's first study in 2007, Jews have been a target of government restrictions or social hostilities involving religion in more countries than any other major religious group, besides Christians and Muslims, even though only about 14.7 million people worldwide identify with the Jewish religion, which is about 0.2% of the world's population. By comparison, there are nearly 2.4 billion Christians, 31% of the global population, and roughly 1.9 million Muslims, 25%, according to the center's most recent figures. So from my perspective, Jews clearly see a disproportionate share of restrictions and hostilities, and recent events in Gaza aren't helping. So Rabbi Mendel Mintz, is there any other context you'd like to share with respect to anti-Semitism? I know I've tried to sum it up really quickly, and I'm sure you've given it considerable thought, but any other general thoughts you'd like to share before we really kick it off?
That's a great question, Dan, and many people have debated it, discussed it, and try to get to the root of it. And I think that sometimes the simplest answer is the correct one. It's irrational. You mentioned the population numbers, how in the world total there's under 15 million Jews, 0.1 or 2% of the overall population of the world, not even a statistical significant number in any way, yet a disproportionate amount of negative energy and hate is focused on Israel and Jewish people. And it's completely irrational. It makes no sense, considering how much Jewish people have done for humanity, for values, for morality, for being our closest ally in the Middle East. The United States is closest ally. So I'm not sure there's any good rational reason for it. I don't think it makes any sense, and I'm not sure what really to make of it. It's unfortunate, and I wish I had a good reason. I just never saw a good one.
Do you, I guess just putting it in local context, do you feel that Aspen in the Roaring Fork Valley feels more or less anti-Semitism from what you hear about and understand nationally and globally?
You know, also a good question. I, on a personal level, I want to point out that I have never personally here in this valley, and I'm here for 25 years. This summer will be 25 years. I've never experienced anti-Semitism myself, directly to me or to my family. There's been some superficial things, some comments made to others or which came back to me. So I think there's very little of that here. I think we live in a very tolerant valley. I think there's obviously negative thoughts and energies and hate in all places. But I do think this valley is very positive, people giving each other the space they need to express their views, to listen to each other. So I think a super majority of our friends and neighbors, I don't see any of that here. And to the contrary, since October 7th, I don't think a week has gone by where a stranger in this valley hasn't called me or reached out to me via email, expressing their support, their love, their good wishes to me and the Jewish community and Israel and Jews the world over. And similarly, whenever I'm walking the streets, whether it's at City Market, you know, buying groceries or taking a hike, people have stopped me at all times expressing love, warmth, support, and good wishes, and that means a lot. So I would say in this valley, I can't compare it to other places, but I think we're doing quite well here.
That's interesting. That's encouraging to hear. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but it seems like it's an overwhelming disproportionality. So that's good to hear.
Indeed. And it warms my heart when that happens, as you can imagine.
Switching a little bit, I've never considered myself very religious, but I will say in my later years, I would say Judaism intrigues me more than other religions have intrigued me in the past. And so, as I've studied this issue, even before I was planning to do a show on it, I learned more and more. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to share what do you see as the essence of Judaism for our listeners, just to help, you know, again, set the stage.
Was that the essence of Judaism? Or?
Yes, yeah.
So Judaism is very simply bring a piece of heaven down to earth, make the world a better place, build trust, build values, spread godliness, spread love, spread warmth, being there for one another, and ultimately bringing the world into an era where there's peace, where there's respect, where there's dignity. Now, obviously, Judaism has, you know, thousands of traditions and rules and laws, but the underlying element of it all is making a home here on physical material earth for God, meaning that everyone treats one another. Where do you find godliness? Where there's love, where there's warmth, where there's respect, where there's human dignity. And the way to do that is that we're empowered by God. Humans have the ability to go and make a difference. Birth is God saying you matter. The fact that you and I were born, we matter. The world cannot exist without us. Every life has tremendous value, and our job and our goal and our role is to perfect the world a little bit at a time. And while it may seem dark, it may seem negative, I think looking at it from an historical perspective, we've come a very long way. We've done quite a bit, and I'm proud to say I think a lot of that has been Jewish and contributions, which have been biblical prophecies as well. So if I had to say in short what my mission or what the Jewish mission is or the biblical mission or the Abrahamic faith is to make this world a better place, bringing a piece of God down here to earth. And the way we do that practically is with acts of goodness and kindness.
Wow. And as a layman, My hunch is that's rare with other religions, or is it? Am I just not familiar enough?
You know, Dan, I'm not an expert on other religions, so I can't speak for Christianity and Islam or any other religion. I have respect for it because the fact that God created, I respect every human being. If God created you, that's worthy enough for me to respect you, and I don't need any other reasons, religious or not. I have a deep respect for every human being, and it's a foundation of what I teach and how I was taught and how I was raised and how I try to raise my children. So I do think one of the principal differences is that Judaism is not looking to convert others to Judaism. Judaism says you were born just fine. Be the best person you are. Be the best you can be. Use your talents, use your gifts, use your abilities, and make the most of them. Whereby other religions, there may be an element where to get to complete redemption or fulfillment, whatever it may be, they may expect you to embrace that religion. From a Jewish perspective, that is not the case. From the Jewish view, if you're a Christian, you can find complete meaning, purpose, and redemption as a Christian, as a Muslim, and for that matter, any other religion. Judaism is for the Jewish people, and not because it's better, it's just a way of life, and it's something you're born into.
Okay, thank you for that. And would you say that Judaism, or maybe just simply being Jewish in the United States, is simply an extension of what it's like in Israel, or is it different being across the pond, as they say?
I think it is different because, first of all, Israel is a Jewish land. It's a majority, population is majority Jewish. I believe there's around 7 million Jews in Israel and about 2 million Muslims or Arabs living in the state of Israel, which no one speaks about, by the way, how Israel has such a large population of Muslims and Arabs who live there with, you know, in freedom and with full rights to democracy and on. But I think in the United States, we are a minority. While we feel embraced and accepted and loved and appreciated, I think there's a difference in that in Israel, the calendar is centered around Jewish holidays. The schooling is centered around Jewish values and principles to some degree. So while I would say there are many similarities and many things in common, there are some things that are a little different. And for me, as an American, I was born in this great country. For me, when I go to Israel, I walk the streets, I feel alive. I feel a sense of history. I'm walking the same streets as King Solomon, as Abraham, as, you know, giants in our past and figures that we all read about or heard about or know about. So there's something unique and special about it that I feel is different from this country to Israel. Although in terms of how things function and how they run, there are a lot of similarities. And for an American, they would feel right at home in Israel.
Okay. And, you know, I made this assumption, but I'm now thinking maybe I should ask this question that when I think of Judaism and Israel, even though, like you said, there are plenty of Arabs living in Israel, I'm not very familiar with many Muslim countries or countries that would describe themselves as Muslim. Do you feel that there's a strong connection between Judaism and Israel? Like I said, I kind of made that assumption, but is that a fair assumption?
Oh, that is a foundational assumption.
Yeah.
If I had to say, the elements of Judaism are monotheism, belief in a one God, which was founded by the idea was by the founder of Judaism, really of modern religion as a whole. Abraham being the father of Judaism, of ultimately Christianity and Islam, and perhaps even other religions. So monotheism is a foundational belief of Judaism, as well as the people of Israel and the land of Israel, and the Torah, meaning the Bible of the five books of Moses. So they're all intertwined. The Jewish people, the land of Israel, and the Bible are all intertwined. If you take one of those away, they're all lacking. So the land of Israel was promised in the Bible to Abraham and to his descendants. And since the Jewish people crossed the Jordan River over 3,500 years ago, after the exodus, after the slavery in Egypt, there's, I believe, always been, while many of us have been in exile in foreign lands, there's always been a Jewish presence in the land of Israel, in the biblical land of Israel, even if it were just a few people throughout the centuries.
Okay. And, you know, later I have questions that, you know, I wonder if some of the anti-Semitism comes from the happenings in Israel, which is why I asked the question. I just wanted to, you know, see that or hear your response to that. Would another thing that I read that I thought was quite interesting, and I want to make sure or see if you agree with it, is would you say that Judaism or Jewishness is a religion formed out of displacement and oppression?
Not at all.
Not at all.
The contrary.
Okay.
I don't see myself as a victim or think of Judaism in a victim mentality. Judaism was a light onto the world and a light onto the nations. And as mentioned earlier, the sole purpose of Judaism is to bring a piece of heaven here to earth, is to make the world a better place. And I think every Jew, consciously or subconsciously, has that job, has that mission, has that purpose to make the world better, which is really the purpose and job of not just of Jews, but really every human being, to partner with God in making this world a happy, healthier, better place with respect and dignity and freedom and all the blessings that God has given us in our beautiful world. So Judaism was really, at its founding, it was really a mission statement to go out and change the world. And you see it from the beginning, be it the Ten Commandments and how we treat one another, how we live our lives, how we see our place in the world, how we see ourselves, how we see the other. And it's enlightening, it's inspiring, and it gives people meaning and purpose, which is the greatest blessing.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked that question. And I realize that we definitely can't underestimate the trauma, or at least I don't want to estimate the trauma that Israelis and perhaps all Jews feel with, given all the anti-Semitism over the centuries. And I personally think that the world unfairly judges Israel in how it approaches its own security and sovereignty. I think that can go in both directions, but I think clearly there are dynamics in Israel and in surrounding countries that we just in the U.S. simply can't fathom and understand. I think it's fair to say that Israel's never really had a partner in the peace process, meaning Palestinians. Doesn't mean that Palestinians don't feel that Israel hasn't always been as dedicated to the process, but it's made it for a much more complex situation than I think the media leads on to believe. And so with that, my next question is there anything that you think non-Jews and or the media misunderstand about Jews or Judaism or Israel or anti-Semitism that's just being either overlooked, not clarified, mischaracterized, or anything like that?
Ooh, that's where do I start with that one?
Okay.
So let me pick on a few of those points. And, you know, when you look at what Israel is doing and how the world sees it. You know, there's some things that just, you know, make no sense. No Jew or no human being, for that matter, would suggest that Israel is perfect or they're doing everything right. And for that matter, no American would say that about the United States or any person would say that about any country. But when you look at Israel and take the United Nations as an example, they've had 45 resolutions against Israel for human rights and all kinds of other activities. This is, by the way, a democratically elected government, very similar to the values of our government and how human beings are treated. So, for instance, Israel has a Supreme Court justice who's an Arab or a Muslim. There's members of its own parliament who are Arab and Muslim. And how many Jews do you think live in Gaza? The answer is zero, because if they lived there, they wouldn't be alive. You'd have a few minutes of life. If I showed up in Gaza, I would be murdered. And I think most Jews know that. And then you look at the United Nations and those 45 or so resolutions against Israel, And then you think of the world we live in, and even superficial knowledge. Iran, that beats women who don't cover their hair and murders them. The president who died today in a plane crash was known as the Butcher of Tehran for the thousands of his own citizens he murdered, going back to the 1980s. And he's someone sadly celebrated in the world. You have North Korea. What? Look what they're doing to their own people. And I could go on to other countries, be it Russia and on and on. And there's less than five resolutions combined over the last few decades against all of those countries. And yet 45 resolutions against Israel. Suddenly when it comes to Israel, something's very wrong. And obviously the standards are, you know, the double standard is horrific and a disgrace and really heartbreaking, because what it does is it allows perpetrators of evil and injustice to get away from their behavior, for their negative and bad behavior, while blaming Israel that strives to make every effort to protect human decency, human freedom, and dignity, and regardless of one's race, religion, or whoever they may be. So, you know, looking at the world as a whole, there's so many things people can do, but I think the first and foremost thing is respecting another person, regardless of who they are. That's fundamental and foundational. And I do think people that oftentimes, instead of educating themselves, instead of reading and taking the time to not judge and be less judgmental, too often fall into the trap of saying, my life is not where I want it to be. And instead of taking responsibility for their own lives, why not go blame someone? And who's the easy person to blame? Jews perceived correctly or incorrectly seem to be successful. Some certainly are. Some certainly struggle, like all demographics and populations. And they seem to be doing okay. And it's their fault. They took away this or they took away that. And, you know, the whole argument about colonization and on and on. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, even now, just a study a couple of weeks ago pointed out how a substantial portion of Israelis living in Israel share a Y chromosome, over 70%, with Palestinian Muslim Arabs who share the same chromosome at about 80%. So meaning, if there's colonizers, it's you and I here in this country, but Israel, Israelis have been there, Jews have been there, belong there, they're from there, and always have been there. So I think when people look at the core and see the contributions of Israel to the world and see what they stand for and what they represent and the values they represent, I think it is very clear that many more people would say thank God for Israel, thank God for everything they have done in making the world a better place, from in fields of technology and medicine, and the list goes on, and science and physics, in contributing to bettering humanity and bettering society and the world around us. And I think if they took a step back and actually read and learned and appreciated the world we live in, and looked at the world instead of with a pessimistic eye, but with an optimistic view, they would come to the conclusion how valuable Israel is and how important and significant it is for the world.
All right. Thank you.
I hope I answered some of that question. I know it was a lot of elements to it.
No, I thought you did a beautiful job. I think I'm, you know, as you gave me permission to before the show, I may challenge a couple of those statements in a little bit. But before we go there, I just wanted to talk about more recent events in the United States that I think is comes to mind when people think about anti-Semitism. And it's almost like the more protests there are on universities, the harder it is for me to really understand what's behind them. I see clear disrespect and some hatred, but I also see a battle of ideologies, I think. And so my question to you is, how do you view the current cultural conflicts on the universities in particular? Maybe there's others you
want
to
reference. Thank you, Dan. I think there's two elements there. What's going on many universities and college campuses around the country. One is, and universities have come out and said this themselves, the NYPD has said this about Columbia, that many of the people demonstrating and causing problems of all kinds have no affiliation with the school. They're rabble-rousers, they're troublemakers, they're looking to spew some kind of hatred or some kind of anger at whoever it may be it Israel, be it Jews, or be it the United States. They're burning American flags, which is painful to see. They're cursing this country, which is hard to see. No one forced anyone to live here or come here. And so when you see things like that, it's obviously painful. And then there's a group of students that get caught up in it. They're confused. They're young. They're well-intended and well-meaning, but they're also ignorant. And there's been people have gone around and asked them, you know, for instance, a lot of people say free Palestine and Jews have to get out, which means the annihilation of Israel and Jews. And they say from the river to the sea. And if you ask them which river, which is the Jordan River, they have no idea what you're talking about. And which sea, which is the Mediterranean, they don't know what you're talking about. And if you talk to them for 4 or 5 minutes, they really have no idea what's going on. Part of it, I think, is the some of the professors and teachers corrupting the minds of our youth and telling them things that are not factually based and accurate and giving them a negative view of our country and Israel and Western democracy as a whole. And some of that, again, is people just showing up who are professionals, who are paid by organizations. And, you know, someone's paying for all this, and it's not the students who are funding a lot of this stuff, be it the tents and all these other things. So I think there's two ways to look at it. The professionals, I think, should be dealt with very harshly. The organizers who, you know, violate student conduct and code, you know, should be dealt with. And I think the people there who are just confused and lost hopefully can get educated and learn about what's going on. And if you talk about universities, imagine, just for a second, you may recall what happened in Congress when the presidents of Penn, Harvard, mm-hmm. and MIT, I believe, were testifying before Congress, and they said, if calling for the annihilation of Jews, does that violate the code of conduct? And they said, depends on the context. Imagine if you just change those words and take out Jews and say blacks or Latinos, the uproar that we would have seen, the rioting we would have seen across this country, the anger, and rightfully so, that we would have seen around this country. Yet when they said it about Jews, it didn't seem, you know, to be that big a deal. One of them did resign some weeks later, 1 month later. And that's really heartbreaking to see these elite schools who you would hope and think are, you know, creating the minds and molding the minds of the next generation and our future leaders. You would hope that they would be more assertive and more direct in calling out hate and saying it the way it is, instead of hiding behind context and what it may mean or not mean. So while it's disappointing what's going on, I think it was also an eye-opener for a lot of the country, what I like to call Middle America, who sees this and says, this is not who we are or we want to be a part of. And I think it's going to benefit Israel and help Israel when people see this type of irrational hate going on.
I'm going to thank you for that. I'm going to pause for a second and say that we are near the bottom of the hour. It is 4:28. You're listening to the Meet in the Middle show on KDNK, Community Access Radio. I'm the host, Dan Richardson, and my guest is Rabbi Mendel Mintz. Today's show is What's Behind the Recent Rise in Anti-Semitism. So getting back to the what's happening on the universities, where we're seeing this recent rise in mistreatment is not the right word, but I'll use mistreatment of Jews. Do you see it as largely anti-Semitism separate from the conflict between Hamas and between Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians, or is it something different? Could it be that it's some of it is possibly resentment or frustration with a country and its people who have, frankly, garnered more support and influence from the U.S. than others?
I'm not sure what garnering support and influence, how we measure that, and what the line is for, you know, which countries have more or less of it. Mm-hmm. And how that's done. I think allies generally work together, and countries that have things in common, such as democracy and freedom and human dignity, we see a lot of that versus countries that don't. Think of Europe and, you know, Western countries, and Israel certainly falls into that camp. Mm-hmm. But I think a significant part of it is simple, plain Jew hatred, and most of these people probably never met a Jew or know what a Jew is. Some, of course, are misguided, but those who know what they're doing, I think at the core, it's pure Jew hatred and nothing else.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I hate to hear that, right? I think maybe to, I do think that, well, I'll put it this way. I have found some statistics that help quantify that support. And one of the big questions I have is what I just asked you is, you know, what is hatred versus frustration or dislike of of the country of Israel? And I think to me, I don't remember whether I read this or heard these different perspectives and how it influences how Americans think about Jews and the country of Israel. And it's, you have the baby boomers, and they saw Israel as, you know, pre-1967, they saw it as a, and maybe pre-1947, as Israel as a weaker, well, I guess before 1967, as a weaker nation, small, vulnerable. They saw the atrocities of the Six-Day War in 1967. They saw Israel's neighbors, how they tried to strangle Israel while it was young. And at this time, Israel was ranked 24th on the list of countries receiving aid from the U.S. And according to the Pew Research Center, again, in their 2022 survey, of baby boomers, or generally that generation, 69% or thereabouts have a favorable view of Israel. And then my generation, the Gen Xers, I'm 51, we know a stronger Israel, a nuclear power, unwavering support from the U.S. We saw Israel climb the ladder to being number one in the U.S. Basically since I was born, so my entire life. I would say that the people I know and associate with, and maybe my generation, has what I would call two-state optimism, in part due to Israel's commitment to peace, at least certainly prior to, I would say, Netanyahu. And my generation is able to empathize, as you stated earlier, Rabbi Mintz, with Israel for the events of October 7th. And then you have the third characterization, that the millennials and younger have watched Israel become an increasingly, I would say, occupying state in some ways, and some would say oppressive to Palestinians. And some would say, you mentioned earlier that Arabs in Israel have the full democratic rights. I think many would disagree with that, that they don't have the full rights of a Jew in Israel. And one that seems to have abandoned the two-state solution. They have seen a devastating response after October 7th, whether it's justified or not. It's clearly devastating, blockading aid to Gaza. And I've even heard the term security through subjugation. And so the Pew survey reports that 56% of this generation has an unfavorable view of Israel. And so I think there's clearly these different camps. And I think part of what we're seeing is this, people just have different perspectives. But before I go any further, I just thought I'd say, are those fair characterizations, or what are your thoughts on that?
I think you are. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you're by and large correct, and that's what the polling shows, and probably just life's experience have shown probably most of us, you know, the older generations and tend older in the last, you know, the first two demographics you shared, I think I'm much more pro-Israel. But I'll point out a couple of things and just one little slight correction. Arabs, when I say Arabs, I mean who have full rights. I mean the Arabs living in Israel, not in the West Bank.
No, I agree.
Or Gaza. Gaza is not Israel.
But there will be people who disagree that even Arabs living in Israel have the same rights as Jews.
They do by law. Now, maybe there's discrimination, right, just like in any other country. Sure. But by law, they have the same ability to do what any other Israeli can do, or Druze can do, or Christian can do, and the like. There's obviously many religions in Israel, and they have the ability to travel freely, to live freely, to run for office, to obviously, as a significant minority, they may feel different and feel that, but many people are in their colleges and universities, many of the Muslims and Arabs, and well received and respected there. And so, yeah, I'm sure there's some who would say there's discrimination and the like, and I wouldn't deny that. Not that I know of enough statistics or enough to comment on that. But I think there's another interesting element you pointed out. I bet that if you look at, the younger generation, whether it's the millennials or, Gen Z, whatever you may call it, not only do they have a lesser degree support of Israel, they'll also have a much more or stronger negative view of our country.
Mm-hmm.
Whereby the generation of post-World War II had a much more positive and healthy view of the United States. And I think it's really a question that goes to the core of this country. What are we doing and not doing? What are we teaching or not teaching that so many young people have a negative view of the United States, of Israel, of democracy, of all the blessings that this country has? Again, it's far from perfect, but tell me where it's better so I can go there. Obviously, I don't think there's anywhere better.
Right.
Not that we're perfect, but again, we're striving and trying to do the right thing. So I think that's reflective also, not just about Israel, but also on democracy as a whole, the United States as a whole. And it's disappointing to me as someone raising children, and I'm about your age, so I certainly see that, see the older generation, those older than me, much more supportive, those in my generation very supportive, and then the next generation, sadly, a lot of troubling and uncertain or negative feedback.
I think that's fair, and I think it speaks to what I said earlier about how Israel can be unfairly judged about how it's handling situations, clearly in the U.S., we are not necessarily practicing what we preach, that's for sure.
Well, we would all agree, regardless on what side we're on, that we can do a better job as a whole and in this country, and hopefully we're going in that direction. I'm not sure we are, but I hope we are.
Yeah, and I think it's also, as I think about this, and I've had other shows on foreign policy and all kinds of things, that I think as individuals and as a country, it's kind of futile to compare us to perfection, but we can compare us to what we can be. And like you said, I think we'd all agree we can be better.
100%.
Do you think, did October 7th fundamentally change you as a Jew, or do you view it as yet another traumatic event among many?
Oh, big time. I think it changed not just me, but almost every Jew I know it changed. In our lives, we grew up reading about these tragedies in history books or hearing about it from our grandparents. And yet, in my lifetime, I never imagined it would ever happen. The greatest tragedy to the Jewish people occurred just a few months ago, 7 or 8 months ago, when we all thought that those days are long behind us and it will never happen again. And while we all knew that, Hamas's charter is to annihilate Israel or kill Jews, or that was, it wasn't about building their own country, but rather what can we do to annihilate Israel and Jewish people first and foremost, I'm not sure many Jews and Americans, for that matter, wanted to believe it. We just were living in a different reality. And, think of our lives here in the valley. Where are we going to go hike and bike and, have a good day? And we just can't imagine that people get up in the morning and instead of thinking that way, they're, what do I do? How do I kill someone? So I think it was a huge shock and a wake-up call to many of the Jewish people I know. A majority of the Jews in this valley who I communicate with certainly were very disturbed by what happened, shocked by the response of the world, for then blaming Israel for responding in many ways, and just overall how things are playing out. They're obviously very concerned wish it were different, and I think we have a lot of work to do to make sure it is different.
It's hard so far away and not being really connected to the Jewish community here or in Israel for me to really understand how Israelis are feeling about it. But my sense is that there's more support for the response – that Israel has taken since October 7th than not. And I didn't always think that after October 7th. And my question is, and I should disclose that these terms, in my readings, it seems like maybe these are common terms. So I hope I don't overstep, but the terms tribal versus universal. And the question is, has October 7th caused Jews and perhaps Israel to being more tribal as opposed to the universal model that you talked about in the beginning of the show, where you've had to sort of hunker down and be in more of a self-preservation mode than, making the world a better place?
That's a good question. I don't know how to answer that. I'll say this. I think the mood in Israel, and I've been here multiple times since October 7th, and I hope to go back in June, and talking to friends there and reading the newspapers there, both in English and in Hebrew, I think the agenda or goal, I don't use the word agenda, the goal, and it's really a supermajority of Israelis, is that we cannot live side by side with a genocidal, murderous, rapist regime that we witnessed what happened on October 7th and just go on living as if it didn't happen. Not to mention that as we speak, there's still hostages being held, innocent people, men, women, and children. Who knows what's being done to them? We know what happened to many women there. A great thing to watch is what Sheryl Sandberg, the former executive at Facebook, put out. It's available on YouTube, interviewing many of the survivors of rape at that music festival. So I think, I don't think there's a tribal element. I think it's we need to be safe and live in a place where we can raise our children. I think some of it may have been if we can protect ourselves as Israelis, as Jews, living here, what is the purpose of Israel? I mean, other countries in the world threw us out or annihilated us or murdered us. If one of the founding elements of modern Israel, not biblical Israel, but modern Israel was, we're going to be there to protect Jews, that they're not, going to suffer another pogrom, another massacre. And yet that's what happened. And I think it was a huge wake-up call, and it shook Israel like I've never seen in my lifetime. And I think they had a full sense of security. They were booming and thriving and, just building an amazing country. And, the economy was great. And tourism was great. And everything was really going well. And people, I think, took their eye off the ball a bit. And this tragedy happened. And they sort of remembered what the idea of Israel was in the first place for so many Jews whose parents or grandparents came from the darkest places on earth. So I don't know if it's the element of tribal or universal or how to address that, but I do think it certainly everyone had to have a strong look in the mirror and heart-to-heart with themselves and their friends and their elected representatives in light of everything that happened.
I think it's so difficult, and, by the title of my show is Meet in the Middle, and I always say that you don't have to live here. You just have to visit it every once in a while. That is the middle. And I enjoy trying to find these different perspectives. And it's just so difficult because of it's what seemingly like people have compared it to our response to 9/11. And yes, it's true that many Arabs in Afghanistan and Iraq want to see, and Iran for that matter, want to see the destruction of the United States. Maybe that's similar to how Arabs and Palestinians feel about Israel. Maybe not, but we don't share a border with them, and so it's much easier for us to keep our distance, if you were. And we're infinitely more powerful on a global stage. But yet, as I said, I and others feel that the response from Israel has been, too much. It's so difficult to understand that perspective. So
I would point out, Dan, that many people in Israel and outside of Israel think their response hasn't been strong enough.
Oh, I know. I know. I definitely get that.
And I'm not obviously a military person. I don't know anything about that. But just to give you an example, I mean, of, you know, some of the foremost expert on urban warfare, who have seen him enough on interviews on CNN and other places that I actually invited him to speak here this summer, and he's going to be in Aspen in July, speaking at our building, who is John Spencer, who teaches urban warfare for the United States military and the foremost authority. And he just shared in a CNN interview that the U.S. holding back arms is hindering Israel's ability to win the war against Hamas, which only increases the destruction in Gaza, and it slows down the pace of the operations, which prolongs the war and increases suffering for those who are innocent, which no one wants to see, obviously. So I think, you know, when it comes to war, I think the morality of war is it should be done as soon as possible. If a war must be fought, then some wars do. World War II would be an example of that. To me, this war is an example of that. When it's a life versus a death cult, to protect your loved ones and children, and if you're against rape, you're for this war to some degree. So I think, you know, they need to finish it quickly, and sometimes finishing it quickly is harsh, but dragging this on and taking all kinds of political considerations into account, I'm not in the name of, you know, worrying about civilians, I think actually hurts them more sometimes. I'm no authority on any of that, but I think John Spencer is someone good to read and hear what he says about it, as he's the one who was consulting the United States generals in Iraq and Afghanistan and has a lot of experience in this area.
And I can understand that that perspective exists. One of my concerns is that I can't help but think that some of the, again, I'll use the term, mistreatment of Jews is partly due to those who hold the opposite perspective, that Israel's response was overweighted far too much, and we won't argue whether it is or isn't, but the fact that that belief and that perspective rings true for many Americans and many others around the world, I just can't help but think that that is fueling the negative feelings toward Jews right now.
I hear what you're saying, but how do we then reconcile that where were they screaming when 400,000 or 500,000 Syrians were murdered, and I didn't hear much screaming? According to Paul Krugman in the New York Times op-ed just last week, he says there's a genocide going on in Darfur again. Have you heard about that in any papers or anywhere? I haven't. Where he says tens of thousands were killed or being killed as we sit here and speak. Where has the world been when Iran has killed thousands of their own citizens for I'm not sure what crime, if any, for that matter? We know there was no crime. And yet suddenly when it comes to Jews defending themselves, they become very moral and very worried about other lives. Where is it when Arabs are killing Arabs, which happen every day, or Muslims killing Muslims? Nobody seems to care except when there's a Jew involved.
Well, but there's two sides to that coin. I think you saying that if you're against rape, you're for this war, I think is an oversimplification. I think there's no doubt that, and I've already said this, that the world unfairly judges Israel for how it responds. But I would also say that there has been other, you know, you mentioned the 47 UN resolutions, but it's also true that the UN, through resolution, gave birth to Israel, or at least gave birth to the nation state. But now, some Americans will say, no, the only way we'll allow Palestine to have its own state is through a negotiation process, essentially saying we're not going to let UN. So Israel was able to benefit. Israel is benefiting from that. So there's pros and cons in either way. And I think, to answer your question, what I think is if there was a plan, if there was what I would say a reasonable response to aid, if there was, you know, if Netanyahu had a plan, as is now being requested, what's going to happen? What does it look like to say Hamas is no longer? Because we know Hamas is more than just a military. It's a governing body, a pretty lousy one,
right,
but nonetheless.
Right.
And so it just, again, it seems like they're, it's just about annihilation. And I get the, I can try to understand the intent there. But I don't think it's strategic. Yeah, and actually, I don't think it's beneficial to Israel the way they've responded. But anyway, I'll stop and let you respond.
There may be elements of truth in all of that, but you know, a proportionate response it doesn't make any sense. It's not about proportion; it's about eliminating the threat. And if Israel's goal was to annihilate the people, they're doing a horrible job, because I think something like 1% or something. I'm not sure those numbers are accurate. Even the UN lowered their numbers just a couple of weeks ago or a few days ago. But whatever the numbers are, if it's 1%, then Israel's Western military with all these Western bombs and precision equipment is really doing a horrible job if their point was to annihilate another people. And if they want to annihilate Arabs and Muslims, why start there? Why start in Gaza? Start in Israel itself and get rid of the 2 million you have living in, as your neighbors. So obviously, yes, it's all, like you said, an oversimplification of everything going on, and there are no easy answers. We'll all agree on that. And I'm not saying that Israel's way they're doing it is benefiting them. I don't know. I'm not sure what better they should do or shouldn't do. But I do feel that if they don't eliminate this threat, they're dropping the ball and causing a generational mistake.
Yeah, like I said, we could argue about approach, and I think I know something about foreign policy, but in reality, I really don't. So I can't profess to know the answer.
We all know a little. I mean, you say a little knowledge is dangerous. So I think the beauty of what you and I are doing, we can discuss and have respect for one another and different views and opinions and learn and grow. And I'm not sure that's common in a lot of other places.
I think, you know, maybe turning a corner as we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. What I'm seeing, again, as a layman, and I've been studying racism and what's my role in it, and why has it become more prevalent in recent years? And I can't help but think that I see parallels between anti-Semitism and racism. Granted, they're different, but I wonder if it's almost I see something in the MAGA movement where people just feel like they haven't been heard, and they want their voices to be heard because they've been oppressed, or they feel like they've been oppressed, and people
right, they feel that.
Are rising out. And going back to a statement I said earlier, I feel like some of the anti-Semitism is seeing the success of Israel. And again, seeing the U.S. and some would argue the U.N.'s support of Israel is causing others to say no and stick up for who they perceive as the underdog. And I'm wondering if you see that in society, or am I just sort of making
sense? I think using the sports analogy, we all like the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's definitely an element of that by those who don't have the knowledge and sophistication and awareness of what's really going on. I think that's definitely the case. And I think you touched on something there. When you studied, as you have, racism, you know, when you dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and I've read a lot on it, it's so irrational. You mean people hate for no good reason, and their hate is not helping them or benefiting them or solving any of their challenges or problems. And I think in that sense, there is a lot of commonality that, you know, hate overall is unhealthy and irrational, and it does no good. And I think there's a lot of that in when we see racism, at least historically in this country, or for that matter, anywhere in the world.
I think both as a non-Black, non-Jew, I've been shocked at how powerful and durable both are entrenched in our societal norms. And the only thing I can think of, what do you do about it? What do you do about a problem, like you said, that's so irrational? And I can't help but think that the answer is to listen. And I think that's one of the reasons why I like to do this show. I like to challenge you on the other perspective of how people are viewing Israel's response, is whether it's right or wrong. Those people want to be heard. I want to be heard that this is what I feel, and I want it to be authentic listening. And I don't think we as a global society are really on our game with respect to that. So maybe I'll ask a question. And what do you see as, or what do you teach about how to try and make progress in this area?
Well, I think what I teach is how to, teach values, teach morals, teach independent thinking, teach respect, teach about human dignity. And I think if people have those core values, they see the other not as a threat, but as someone who, like them, has ambitions, has dreams, has goals, and has aspirations that they want to achieve and accomplish. And like a lot of people, have a roof over their head, put food on their table, and try to live lives with dignity, meaning, and purpose, and feel good about oneself and one's family. So I think the core is not necessarily tell people what to think, but teach them how to think. And at the core of that is the other, what we do for the other, how we see the other, how we treat the other. And if the foundation of that is decency, respect, and dignity, I believe good things follow.
Okay, well said. And I don't disagree with that, I think. And I would hope you would agree that listening is part of that teaching.
As a matter of fact, the best teaching is listening.
Yeah.
That allows us to be more empathetic and more inspiring teachers.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Rabbi Mendel Mintz, for joining me today. It was an honor. Today's show was What's Behind the Recent Rise in Anti-Semitism. I'm Dan Richardson, and my email address is richardson@roth.net. Thank you for listening to KDNK and Meet in the Middle Show. We'll be back in a month. And once again, I just want to thank you, Rabbi Mendel Mintz, for joining me.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it, and I hope we could do it again sometime.
Great. Have a wonderful day. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.